we're happy to see everyone here tonight. Glad to see a nice crowd out on this cold, cold night. Welcome you to the Historical Society meeting. The reason we're handing out ballots is part of our officers have deserted, so we're trying to get some new people voted in. So if you'll hand your ballots to the end of the rows, if you're done with them, and we'll go ahead with our meeting. Is there any other business that we need to do? Judy has calendars here if somebody wants to buy calendars after the meeting. And there's some membership information and things on the back bench if you're interested in that. So we'll go ahead with Dr. Perks giving his talk on the flu. I'm sure he'll enlighten us on a few things. And we're glad he's accepted to do this tonight. Thank you.
Come in, Lloyd, the only one that remembers the flu epidemic. There's some seats up front here. Well, we certainly welcome you out this cold, wintry night to talk about the flu. First, I'd like to point out that in 1918, the pandemic Spanish influenza killed between 50 and 100 million people. That's a lot of folks. In the United States, it was over 600,000 deaths due to the flu. We've now done research that proves pretty conclusively that the 1918 pandemic A2 flu started in birds and mutated to people. In Star Valley, in Wyoming, in other words, there was over 700 deaths. In Star Valley, we can't get any figures. But Lloyd Baker, who was 7 years old at the time, remembers the flu, and he's here. We'll have some comments from him a little later on. The Star Valley physician who took care of the flu patients was Dr. West. Dr. West came here in 1903 and practiced 42 years. Dr. Treloar came in 1929 and practiced 41 years. Yours truly came in 1956 and practiced 50 and a half years. I did have a nice talk with Dr. West before he died in December of 1956 about the flu epidemic. There's two brothers here, Doctors Byron Rees and Lafayette Rees, and Dr. Lafayette Rees died of the flu. Dr. West told me it wasn't the flu that killed the people, but the complications. In those days, they didn't have any antibiotics.
Pneumonia.
That's a very common complication of flu, is pneumonia. There are two kinds of flu, basically. Type A, which is a serious flu, and type B, which is a play flu. The flu nearly always starts in Asia. It starts in pigs and mutates and goes to people. Now, when we were in China in the year 2000, Gay and I, we went in one little house, and then they had a little TV about that big in the kitchen. In the next room, they had four white pigs, and that's how they live in China, and that's why the flu starts in pigs and mutates and goes to people. We've had several major A2 flu epidemics here: Asiatic, Hong Kong, Beijing, London flu are some of the ones that I can remember since I've been here. The worst flu epidemic we had in Star Valley since I've been here was 1957, the Asiatic flu. At that time, Dr. Treloar and Dr. Worthen and I were here, and we estimated that one-third of the people got sick, one-third of the population. The epidemic lasted about a month, and also, as noted in other of the flu epidemics, the virulence increased the longer it went. The first ones that got sick with the flu weren't too sick, and the last ones that got sick with it were really much more ill. And again, complications was a problem, such as pneumonia. Now, every time we have a flu epidemic, we have a catastrophe. We always have a ruptured appendix because people think everything they got's the flu. I've seen everything from brain tumors to hemorrhoids called the flu. Also, another thing we notice is that it's more a matter of resistance than it is exposure. Some people can be exposed to the flu constantly and never get it because they have a resistance to it. It doesn't really do much good to close the schools except there's not enough kids there to teach anymore. And so we have had several major flu epidemics in the 50 years I've been here. We didn't have the flu shots back in 57. Now they make flu shots every year, and the U.S. Public Service Health Service goes to China or the Far East to find out what viruses are active, and then they try to put these in the flu shot. Not all the active flu shots are in the serum. Sometimes they miss. Remember, a few years ago they thought we were all going to get swine flu and it didn't develop. And so not all the active viruses are in the vaccine. But the flu shots have really helped a lot. I had the London flu, and I'll never forget sitting on a stool trying to get the afterbirth out of a woman with 103 temperature, being the only doctor in Star Valley, one nurse wiping my brow and the other holding me on the chair, keeping me from falling off. And I guess a lucky woman was lucky to survive too. Flu is due to a virus, and one of the problems with influenza is it knocks your white count down, so you have no standing army to fight the pneumonia. With a low white count, you have nothing to prevent you from getting complications on top of it. The incubation period is about 3 or 4 days, so if you've got a flu case in the house, you can expect some more to come down within 3 or 4 days. And the symptoms, as you all know, are feeling bad or malaise, chills and fever, cough. Usually it'll last 5 to 7 days unless you get complications. There are blood tests that'll tell if you have flu. And one of the most significant things we see on the blood test is the low white count, as mentioned. And the treatment is rest and time, an antibiotic for the complications. Now, there's some antiviral agents out, and I've had some sad experiences with those because many of them have neurological complications. So you get a patient with the flu and give them an antiviral agent, and they get a severe headache and tingling and numbness, and you don't know what's going on, so you got to do a spinal tap to make sure they don't have meningitis. And so we have some fairly good agents to give early in at the onset of the flu, but they have some complications too. Flu shots have been a great boon to the community. About 3 years ago, it was hard to get, and so the public health's the only one that could get them. And so they've mostly taken that over, and we'll hear from them a little later. Lloyd, you were 7 years old at the time of the flu epidemic?
Yes.
Do you want to come up here and tell us a little bit about it?
Well, I've had I don't remember a whole lot about it, except I remember how it felt to have the flu, Doctor. Yep. And you've had it, so we had it then. And all of us were sick but my brother Carl. And Carl had to do all the chores. And we had cows to milk and animals to feed and the cows to feed and the whole works. But I remember Carl, and he wasn't... I guess he was five or six at the time, and he had to do all the chores because all the rest of us were sick. Harvey Crook told me a little bit about the flu. Some of you know Harvey, but he got a hold of some whiskey, and he took it throughout the valley and gave it to those people that had the flu in their families. And he went to Aetna and gave it to Joshua Crook and his family. All of them got over it. And he came up to Ray Clark, who was our bishop at that time in Aetna, and tried to get them to take it, and they wouldn't take it. And his wife and two children died in one night. And he was there just before to offer them the whiskey to do it. Now,
Harvey told me they got drunk and laid under the kitchen table. That's how he stayed away from the flu.
He didn't go anywhere, so they had to
stay. Anyhow, Dennis,
I searched 1918. The independence from 1918 for the first 4 months and 1 week of the fifth month, and I saw no reference in there to flu whatsoever. The war was on strong, and I saw the names of hundreds of people, I think, that donated to the war effort and bought stamps or bonds or something like that, but no mention of the flu at all. So this was last night. I spent 3 hours and 15 minutes there trying to find something on the flu. And so I asked Dennis if he would research it a little today and find some information on it. And he's presented me with a little information. I'd like to have him say something about it. But There was a lot of trouble in the flu, and I think one of them was I think they closed the church and the school at the time, and but there were some of them there that were would have the flu, and then I think a lot of got passed around because. When some of you are not church members, but we always pass a sacrament. And at that time, instead of having the individual cups, you had two glasses of water, and you passed one to one side and one to the other, and everybody took a sip of water as a sacrament. And I think that may have had a good deal to spread the flu at that time. But I'll let Dennis tell you what he knows about, if that's all right.
Sure. Sure. Come on up, Dennis.
Well, I had somebody tell me today that they had an armed guard to keep the lower valley from coming to the upper valley during that period of time. You heard of that?
Yeah.
And so... they had more flu in the lower valley than they did in the upper valley. And so they put an armed guard.
Speak right in there, Dennis.
Oh, yeah. I'm not used to these things, you know that. I took some papers from the Independent today, and it says 60 high school pupils have flu, and
and it talks about Dr. West and Dr. Reese. And Dr. Reese says about 30 people are out of high school. It seemed like that most of the people, several of the people died that were 18 years old. And I have a list of some of them. I better put my glasses on. That's your fault.
Always.
Angus Hilliard. He's from Fairview. And Minnie Peterson. He's from Grover, I believe. Vernon Astle from Grover. Mrs. D.W. Williamson. George Anglesey, Roscoe Roberts. Roscoe, he was Charlie Roberts' son. I worked for Charlie. I knew him well. There's a call, too. Verna Call, Minnie, I got that. But she's died. But I couldn't find too much on it. I had papers taken from it. You want?
Go ahead. You can give them to the.
Can we see those?
Give them to the.
No.
Now, are there any? Okay, Paul.
Do we need to stock whiskey at the drugstore now?
I don't think there's any evidence that whiskey helped the flu. It might make it so he didn't notice it so much. Any other questions or comments on this segment? You have any questions or anything you'd like to ask? Jeremy?
Is this Norwalk flu? Is this stomach flu that's going around now?
No. We haven't had even a parainfluenza B epidemic in Star Valley yet. The parainfluenza B epidemic usually starts in children. It's lesser symptoms, some sore throat, runny eyes, hacky cough, and that usually lasts 3 to 5 days. We haven't even had that around this year. But we haven't had a big A2 epidemic, severe one for several years. Flu shots have helped a lot. Question.
Dr. Birch, my parents more or less indicated that the 1918 flu came from Europe at that time. And
well, there's arguments about where it came from, but certainly international travel at that time after the war was more prevalent. But in this day and age, any new viral strain you can that's new and there's no immunity against it, you can plan on being worldwide, being a pan-epidemic. And I think the public health folks will address that.
They had a gate down in the Narrows, and the doctors could go through. They didn't...
Speak up so I can hear.
Speak up.
Speak loud so I can hear you.
He says they had a gate at the Narrows and kept check on the folks, and I've heard that before.
I was told there's an armed guard also.
Frank Hoops was the first man that died.
That isn't the present Frank Hoops, the one that plays the guitar. That's another Martha?
It was his great uncle, his uncle.
Okay, that would be naturally from Fairview.
Uh-huh. There's a lot of pregnant mothers, lots of young mothers that died of the flu, left a lot of homeless children.
Would be nice to know the exact statistics of how many died in Star Valley.
George Johnson told me that he was living in Freedom at that time, and he said they couldn't get enough people to dig the graves. They had to store the bodies for till spring.
You know the worst thing that happened to George Johnson? He was a teamster in World War I, and he had a team of mules. And after the war, they wanted to donate the mules to the French farmers. The government shot him. George Johnson told me that story 18 times.
First thing I found, I took him up to try to teach him how to fish, and he couldn't catch a fish.
Maybe he was thinking of his mules.
I caught 14 fish, and stand right the side of him, change poles, change places, everything, and he couldn't catch a fish.
Any other questions?
I'd like to make a couple more comments.
Okay.
And one is that I never take a flu shot. I had a flu shot when I was in San Francisco when it first came out. And I would have died if my brother Rex hadn't been with me. He stayed with me, and he was in the Army up in the Washington area, and he was a medic in the Army. He came home and saw me with the flu after I'd taken that shot, and he got me out of bed right then and put me in a tub of hot water. I said it was scalding. He said it was lukewarm. But when I got through with that, I passed out on him in the tub, but he kept me out of the, so that I could still breathe, got me to come to, and put me back in the bed, and I was okay. So I stay away from the flu shots. But there's another thing that, and I don't know whether the doctor's familiar with it, I tried to get him to take a book, but there's a little booklet on it, and this is silver, a special preparation of silver that they've documented with research organizations that it's not an antibiotic, but it will kill every germ and every virus, and doesn't have the opportunity for the germs to come around and be worse afterward. And that's a special treatment they've got on silver. That's all I know about it at the present time. I haven't checked it with the flu, against the flu, and know about it. Yes?
Floyd, are you suggesting when you were put in that tub of water that you called very hot, that maybe it was the heat of the water and the heat in the body that killed the flu?
I don't know, but I know what the Rex knew, and that knew what to do, and I got better from then on. I didn't have any problem from then on. I had chills and fever, and when he saw my condition, he just jerked me out of bed and put me in this tub of water. But I don't know, and as far as whiskey is concerned, I think it has a hot lemonade with whiskey in it or something like that. I've been given it a few times, and I think it's tremendous for cold or for flu.
You better stock whiskey, Paul. If there's no further questions on this part, we'll turn it over to the public health people. Okay?
We got your sheet?
No. You're fine. I got a seat.
Thank you, Dr. Ferguson. Thank you, Lloyd and Dennis. We have Sue Pearson here from Kemmer. She's the director over the public health offices in Kemmer and Afton. And Nancy Fox is here in the office in Afton. So we'll turn the time over to them. Will you hand your ballot over if you think you're still holding on to it?
Good evening, and as Dr. Perk said, this is fantastic that you all turned out on such a cold evening. I'm really pleased to see you all, and thank you for letting us have a few minutes of the time from the Historical Society. I've been dying to listen to Dr. Perks forever and to hear the actual accounts of what happened during the 1918 Spanish influenza. I've read books. I can honestly tell you that I've been in nursing for 35 years, and I never heard of it until about 4 years ago. As Dr. Perks remarked, or as Jack?
Lloyd.
Lloyd, I'm sorry. As Lloyd said, there was nothing in the papers about it at the time, or very little in the newspapers about it at the time, because President Wilson wanted to keep the American public revved up to fight and win the war. He didn't want anything that would destroy morale. So the press actually did censor a lot of the news that could have helped and prevent many deaths and many illnesses. As I said, I learned about the flu, the Spanish influenza, in my work as a public health nurse. And we brought some material here, Nancy has, that you can take a look at later. We do recommend The Great Influenza by John Barry. It's an excellent account of what happened. And the scientists that were involved in investigating the disease and trying to find the cause. Can you all hear me okay?
I can't hear you.
I'll talk louder. Okay? Is that better?
Yeah.
Okay, I hope I don't blast you out now. Okay.
You might blast the others out. You won't blast me out.
Okay. I have a very short slide presentation, and I'll go through it quickly because Dr. Perks touched on a lot of the topics in it. But I did want to read a little bit of an account that I took off the internet, and it kind of sums up what I wanted to share with you about influenza, the avian influenza. Dr. Perks talked about the Spanish influenza of 1918. That disease and that pandemic was caused by the H1N1 virus. That virus disappeared for many years, and it basically mutated into a less lethal form. And it circulates now. It's making people ill now, but not nearly as ill as it did back then. And very often we put the H1N1 components from that virus we use to make vaccines that we give every year. The reason we give those vaccines every year is because they only last, 6 to 8 months, and then the next season, flu season, another virus may be the more virulent one, and so we have to change the formula. But anyway, H1N1 started the Spanish influenza, and now, since 1997, we've had another virus that started out in birds called H5N1. That virus is now circulating in Asia, in Southeast Asia, in Africa, in the Middle East. It's gone up into Russia. A total of 55 countries, all on the other hemisphere. It hasn't come to the Western Hemisphere yet, but on it's infected birds, migratory birds and domestic birds and commercial birds in 55 countries. Now, it has gone from birds to humans, and it is infecting humans. It's infected roughly 260, and out of the 260 that we know and have confirmed as being infected with this virus, it has killed over roughly 60 now, or pardon me, over 160. In fact, it just killed 4 people last week. Now that, when you think of the billions of people, I mean, we've got 16,000 people in Lincoln County, and the millions of people in the world, why are we worried about 260 infections? Well, it's not so much the number of infections as it is the potential for this virus to become more easily transmitted from human to human and cause a pandemic just like the one in 1918. The studies that they've done on the H5N1 virus are proving that it is almost identical to H1N1 when it caused the 1918 pandemic. Canadian researchers, it's just been in the news in the last day or two, Canadian researchers revived that 1918 virus and infected macaque monkeys with it. The monkeys got so ill, they showed symptoms within 24 hours, and they were going to keep the monkeys alive and experiment with them for about 21 days. They couldn't stand it. The monkeys were so sick, they euthanized them in 8 days. So that's how virulent the H1N1 virus was, and in this instance is, and H5N1 is just as virulent. We're looking at approximately a 60 to 70% more case fatality rate. That means 60 to 70% of the people that get it die. Many of them, even though they have been given antivirals. In the news this week, too, we're seeing that Egypt, there were some cases in Egypt where the scientists now and the physicians have documented that the virus has mutated and has reached a point where it is developing resistance to Tamiflu. Tamiflu is the drug that you hear about all the time, the most sought after antiviral for national stockpiles now to have on hand should a pandemic break out. So what you need to know about pandemics is that there won't be a vaccine and there may not be any drugs to help it. So maybe Lloyd's whiskey tonic may be a good thing, and we probably need to put it on our signs. But one of the most common questions...
All but one of those people listed in the paper, all but one died of pneumonia.
Yeah, and pneumonia is one of the complications of H5N1. Also this week, what they discovered with the monkeys was that the theory about the virus causing a cytokine storm, they've proven that theory now. And what that means is that the virus is so virulent, it's so nasty, that when it infects the human body, it triggers the human immune system to actually go into overdrive and produce so many substances to fight the virus and so much fluid that people actually drown in their own fluids that fill up the lungs, they destroy the lung tissue.
That's what pneumonia is.
It's really nasty. So I just wanted to share this one little update, and then I'll show you the slides, and then I'll hand it over to Nancy. This was something that I took off the internet today, and it's by a Dr. Gerber. Pardon me. Yeah, he's written a book called Bird Flu, Epidemic of Our Own Making, and our own hatching, pardon me. And this is what he has to say, and I will just read it to you because it sums up everything I wanted to share with you about the current state of affairs. One of the most common questions I get asked on the road is, whatever happened to bird flu? To quote my favorite public health blogger, a blogger is somebody that writes a lot of stuff on the internet. It says, ask the people in Vietnam, South Korea, and Nigeria. The virus doesn't care if you know where it is or not. Whether or not H5N1 ever arrives on U.S. soil as a bird virus, should it mutate into a pandemic virus, geographic borders would be essentially meaningless. Indeed, in the just released Global Risks of 2007, the World Economic Forum lists pandemic flu as one of the greatest risks of global major systemic disruption for the new year. If anything, the risk may be growing. According to the World Health Organization, more people died in 2006 from bird flu than did in the three prior years combined. Most of them were under 20 years old. And that's a comment on that, and that you said that a lot of the younger 18-year-olds and younger teenagers died. That was a characteristic of the 1918 flu, and it's a characteristic of H5N1 as well. It seems to have the most lethal effect in age groups from 20 in the teens up until about 40 years old. Basically, those people that have the strongest immune systems. Because if it's putting the immune system into overdrive, those people that have the strongest immune systems are going to react the strongest and will have more complications. So there's more mortality in that age group. This is different from seasonal flu, where we talk about the very young and the very old being most at risk for severe complications. So anyway, it's still smoldering, said Dr. Anthony Fauci, who heads the U.S. scientific efforts to combat bird flu. The danger of a pandemic is as profound now as it was a few years ago, reiterated David Nabarro, who is the flu director for the United Nations. In regards to the threat of pandemic flu, the new Director General of the World Health Organization, Margaret Chan, who just took office, said that complacency is our biggest enemy. 2007 marks the 10-year anniversary of the first human death from H5N1. If H5N1 were able to trigger a pandemic, wouldn't it have done so by now? That's a lot of people will question that and argue that, well, it hasn't done it in 10 years, so if it was going to, it surely would have by now. Some evidence suggests that the 1918 flu virus, which triggered the greatest medical disaster in history, was smoldering for at least 11 years before it went pandemic. We simply don't know enough about the biology of these viruses to accurately estimate a timeline. H3N8, a different virus, for example, circulated in horses in North America for nearly 40 years before jumping into dog populations and triggering the canine flu that grabbed headlines in 2005. Did anybody read about that? I raise dogs. I raise little Bichons. And so I keep them well vaccinated and I watch for dog diseases. And it did start in Florida and killed quite a few dogs before they recognized this epidemic within the dog population. With regard to H5N1, a World Health Organization and the USDA research team has concluded it's probably dangerous to rely on the if it were going to happen, it already would have argument. John Oxford wrote the book on influenza, literally, co-authoring the standard textbook, Influenza, the Viruses, and the Disease. In his generous review of bird flu in the December 21st issue of the prestigious science journal Nature, he answered why we should concern ourselves with the 150 or so human deaths to date. So remember I said, why are we worried about 260 some odd infections and 100 and some odd deaths? This is why. Go back to 1916 in northern France, where a form of flu causing heliotrope cyanosis, that's a characteristic lavender coloration of the face. And that's because of a lack of oxygen, okay? Can't breathe, no oxygen. You turn lavender, turn black, turn blue, you can turn colors. Okay, this heliotrope cyanosis, with a case fatality of 60%, was beginning to spread. So 1916 in northern France, we had the beginnings of a disease that was causing these symptoms, and it was beginning to spread. There were 145 cases. At some point in the next 2 years, it mutated to become more infectious and 30 times less virulent. Then it killed 50 million people. Doesn't this ring a nasty bell? 145 cases then, 2 years before it broke out. And we're looking at similar numbers right now. According to the director of the National Center for Disease Preparedness at Columbia University, most scientists remain convinced that we most certainly will encounter a deadly H5N1 global pandemic at some time in the future. Why then the loss in media interest? Okay, remember we said that there wasn't much in the newspapers at the time, in 1918? How come there's nothing in the papers about it now? Or very little? Every once in a while you'll see a little something. But for the most part, we're much more interested in who's going to win American Idol. We're much more interested in Paris Hilton and her latest escapades. Not to mention that there's a monster at our door waiting to barge in. Okay. One intriguing possibility is that reporters have intentionally been trying to downplay the pandemic threat. On behalf of the Trust for America's Health and Columbia University School of Public Health, researchers conducted one-on-one interviews with TV, radio, and print journalists who cover public health issues. Numerous respondents said that they have purposely toned down their coverage or passed on pandemic flu stories altogether, so as to present the news without inducing panic. The study suggested that the reporters were very knowledgeable, but fear that passing along too much of this knowledge to their readers will lead to panic. But public complacency, according to the dean of the Harvard School of Public Health, is the biggest roadblock to pandemic preparedness. The American public wants to see in depth more reporting on the subject. This patronizing attitude revealed in the study suggests that some journalists may be holding back instead of providing the full story that might otherwise motivate people to action. Okay. There's more, but I don't want to read that. It's boring to read things. But I think that gives you an idea of what's happening now. It's out there. The threat is there. It's growing slowly but surely. It's spreading to more and more countries. It's mutating. We still don't have a medication for it that has proven totally effective, and we won't have a vaccine. So what do we do about it?
I looked through the Independent back in 1918 and 19, and there was very little on the flu there. I have couple articles, and we looked and looked, and there just wasn't any more.
They're really hard to find.
Yep. One thing I didn't point out is it takes time to make a specific flu shot because it has to be incubated in eggs. It takes a lot of eggs and a lot of time.
That's a good point. I'm glad you brought that up, Dr. Perks.
You're allergic to eggs, you're allergic to that, too.
Our process to make vaccines at this point in time requires millions of eggs, chicken eggs. And guess what H5N1 is killing? Chickens. So the production of a vaccine that is specific for H5N1 is going to take time. They're working on one now, but if the virus mutates, that vaccine may not work. So we'll be back to square one. And while we're talking about vaccines, you know I can't let it go. We have a lot of flu vaccine in the public health offices because our manufacturers sent it out very late this year. There is no shortage. Within the next couple of months, if I don't give it to people, I'm going to have to throw it away. And that would be a terrible waste. And if I throw it away, the county loses money, and I'm going to lose my ability to order more. You know, this isn't the county's fault, but I can't show a loss every year. So I'm urging you to please, you know, if you know someone that hasn't gotten a flu shot yet, please give us a call so we can use this vaccine appropriately and not have to waste it. And in regards to the...
It's not too late.
The flu season very often peaks in February and March. So if we don't have very much of it in the valley now or in the county now, it may still get here. There's a whole lot of it going on the East Coast. In fact, many school districts have closed that have never closed before, and they've sent 20, 30,000 children home because of what's going on the East Coast. So that may get here. And in regards to the vaccine making people sick, we hear that on a daily basis. Every time we go out to give flu shots, people will swear to us that they got a flu shot and it made them sicker than they ever were before. Well, I have an explanation for that. And I believe what they're saying. They probably did get a flu shot and probably were very, very sick. But what I question is whether it was the shot that made them sick. If you realize the mechanism and how a vaccine works, if I give you a flu shot today, you won't have full immunity against any viruses until 2 weeks from now. So you may be sitting here right now, you may have been exposed to a flu virus, it hasn't started any symptoms yet, so you go in and get a flu shot just because you want to get a flu shot, and then a couple of days later you get really sick. Well, it wasn't the shot that made you sick, you were already exposed to the virus, and that's what made you sick because the shot didn't have a chance to build up your immunity. And then I do have to acknowledge that years ago, sometimes the vaccine processes, the manufacturing processes, weren't as rigid and as well policed as they are nowadays. We had a flu shortage a couple of years ago because a manufacturer didn't meet the strict standards that we require for vaccine production now. Maybe it was a bad batch. I can't say. But what I can say is that vaccine that we give now is one of the safest vaccines there is, and it is proven effective. But no vaccine is 100%. So, you know, you still take your chances, but it's better than anything we've ever had before. Yes?
It was explained to me at one time, however, that the flu shots at that time had a live flu in them, mm-hmm. and that's the reason the flu took me.
That could have been.
And the future manufacturing standards were up so that couldn't be done, and the present flu shot wouldn't do that. Mm-hmm. But that was explained to me that was a possibility.
Yeah.
So I'm still going to keep my silver and my case of whiskey on hand.
I can't recommend any alternative medicine modalities, any other treatments other than what we usually use in our everyday medicine. But that doesn't mean to say that something someday isn't going to prove effective. We wouldn't have aspirin today if somebody wasn't scratching birch bark off a tree one day and discovered that it had medicinal properties. So, you know, I can't say that it's useless. I can't say that it works. Time will tell.
A question about when you say someday it might be possible to be available. Are you talking about from the medical standpoint that it might be available? Is that where you're talking it would come from?
A vaccine?
Yeah.
They are working on trying to develop a manufacturing process for vaccines now that don't require chicken eggs. It's called a DNA process or a cell culture process. And the companies are working furiously because the company that comes up with it is going to be making mega, mega, mega bucks. So they're really trying hard to do that. If we have to rely on the egg production process, then it will be 6 to 8 months, 4 to 8 months. They give us various, but it won't be within the first wave of a pandemic. Let me go ahead.
But you're talking about coming from a medical standpoint, that's what they are saying.
Yeah, that's
you're
what we're being
talking
told.
Talking from any kind of alternative places, but what the medical field is saying.
What the mainstream medical okay. community is saying. The Centers for Disease Control, etc. I just want to show you a couple of quick slides, and then they'll introduce Nancy and what we're doing here in Lincoln County.
Don't move the slides? Can you stay there?
Oh, okay. Sounds good. Can you all see that? Kind of, sort of.
Not very good.
Okay, is that the
slideshow,
or is that just
the... I think it's the slideshow, isn't it? Yeah, next one. Should I push the next one?
Do you
want to do the lights down,
no.
or what do you want to do?
Small.
You trying to do the lights?
Can you blow it up?
Well, we can blow it up by moving it down one. I don't know if we can get
here.
It. Do you want to sit here and do it?
No. Good. Okay, this is just something that I put together pretty quickly, but I would like to take something like this out to all of the communities. When I hear that there's a pandemic starting and it's imminent, education is the best tool that we have to combat this problem. Public health has 6 people in the north end of the county in our office here in Afton, and we have 5 people in the south end. And we are, according to the Wyoming Department of Health, responsible for preparing our counties to get through a pandemic. We can't fix it. And we can't go out and do home health. And we can't go work in the hospital and take care of people. That's not our job. But our job is what we're doing right now. Warning you about a potential threat and giving you ammunition, giving you tools so that you can protect yourself. It's pretty much the same with all of our emergency response. We have few emergency responders and a very big county. We can't all be in the same place at the same time. So we rely on people to know how to take care of themselves in emergencies. Okay. What Dr. Perks already told you about is what is an avian flu, and what we were going to talk about and have talked about already is about what is an avian flu and what is an influenza pandemic, how serious is it, what's being done to prepare Lincoln County, and what you can do to prepare yourself.
Sue?
Yeah.
Can you use
mine?
Can you take the
mic
off?
How's that? Does that work?
Yes.
Okay. My picture slipped. Okay. An epidemic. Then, you know, Dr. Peirce talked about a pan-epidemic, an epidemic, a pandemic. You hear those terms? An epidemic is usually an outbreak of disease, but it's somewhat regional. It's in one particular area. It might even be a whole country, but it doesn't go far, far and wide. A pandemic is one that goes around the world. It's a global epidemic.
Like the Black Death.
Yeah, mm-hmm. At that time.
Killed half the people in Europe.
One quarter of the population of Europe died in 1313, and it hit again in the 1600s, and another quarter died. Two epidemics of the, but that was plague.
Yeah.
And we have an antibiotic that works against plague, but we don't have an antibiotic that works against flu.
We don't have the fleas either.
No.
My microbiology teacher told me years and years and years ago not to worry about the bomb, that the bugs would get us long before then. Okay, how do pandemics occur? And Dr. Perks told you about that too. Avian influenza viruses change. They change their genetic structure. They become capable of infecting humans. And then they can reproduce and spread from person to person. and that's what happens to cause a pandemic. There are certain stages that the World Health Organization has outlined to show us where we are in the process of a pandemic starting. There's six phases, and we're actually in phase three right now. We have a novel virus. No one has any immunity to it. There have been human infections, but they're rare and they're rather localized. So why are we talking about them? Well, I think you pretty much guessed. They are inevitable. They've happened throughout history. They've happened at regular intervals. We are told that we are overdue for one, and we could, it's imminent. It's not if, it's when. And illnesses do spread quickly and globally. It's thought that, what is it, 3 months? Within 3 months, it'll be around the world once it goes easily transmitted human to human.
We are actually more global nowadays than we've ever been, and we were in 1918, even though they had the war on then. We're a lot more global. There's transportation from continent to continent, many, many thousands every day.
That's exactly right. I think it was in 1918 that it took 3 months to go around the world, and they didn't have the air travel or the automobile travel or the high-speed trains. We're much more mobile now, so it will go around the globe a lot faster than it did then. Our healthcare delivery system is going to be overwhelmed. If you're talking 30-40% of the population sick at the same time, how do our little 16-bed hospitals, fine and wonderful as they are, how are they going to handle that kind of a caseload? The schools and daycare centers, libraries, theaters, stadiums, we may have to close them for extended period of time, because as Dr. Perk said, if you have resistance to it, fine, but if you don't, the only way you're going to keep from getting it is to remove yourself from large gatherings. Helen?
At what point would the schools be closed? What would be the indicators for that?
They're working on that at the CDC and in Homeland Security right now. There are university research centers are all performing studies and asking focus groups and all to try and decide what would be the indicator of when to close the schools. I can't say exactly, but I can say that it will be a community decision. Public health bears the responsibility for giving guidance during a pandemic, but we work within the incident command system and with our emergency management and Homeland Security. So we would be working in the Emergency Operations Center, and that decision would be made by the elected officials and by the people in the Emergency Operations Center, public health included. And impacts would last for months, weeks and months and possibly years. Dr. Perks was saying how at one point in the 1918 pandemic, people got sick and it was bad, and then it got really bad. And that's because pandemics come in waves. It'll come, it'll stay, it'll make you sick and make the community sick, and then things will start to get better. And then all of a sudden, a month later, it comes back. And usually, as in the case of 1918, the second wave was the most lethal.
That's what I've noticed in the epidemics of A2 virus we've had in Star Valley, is the virulence or the severity of the virus increases the longer it's around.
Yeah, and they're
once they get it, if you're going to get the flu, get it early when it comes instead of later.
Or a flu shot.
Just go out to get it, huh?
This would be the impact of a pandemic today. If 30-40% of the population was to get sick, and we have 16,000 people, you could count on probably having 4,800 to 6,400 people home sick.
And in 1957, I would estimate in Star Valley, one-third of the people got it. That's just what I said.
Mm-hmm. Now, we're all on the same page. Right now, as I said, with the limited cases that we have, there's a 50-60%, and in some cases 70% case fatality rate. Those are the numbers that die of the people that are infected. If we had a 50% case fatality rate, we're talking about 2,400 to 3,200 people dying. That's a lot of people.
Question, please.
That's more than we've got of newcomers here.
No comment.
If you would get it and are able to get over it, are you susceptible to getting it again?
That's a question that we really don't know, But if we look at history, some of the people that got the influenza in 1918, when the second wave came around, they were immune, but others were not. So it's one of those unpredictable things about the virus, we just don't know. So, you know, what we're here for is to encourage pandemic flu preparedness. Our objective, public health's objective, what we would like to do is limit sickness and death, maintain continuity of essential services. If 30 to 40% of the population is homesick, that means 30 to 40% of road and bridge is going to be homesick. 30 to 40% of whoever keeps the electricity going is going to be homesick. They're not homesick, they may be home taking care of sick people or watching the children that got sent home from school. We want to minimize the social disruption and the economic loss. Go ahead. So we're working with healthcare system partners. We're putting systems in place to detect and track the pandemic flu. All of our physicians have been given instructions for surveillance. What questions to ask if someone presents with a flu-like illness and we know that it's gone human to human? Have they traveled to the Orient lately? Have they been around other people who have had the disease? There's surveillance questions that they know to ask. Because the sooner we find it in the county, we'll try to contain it. We won't be able to stop it, but we can buy us some time. And we're asking governments, businesses, and community organizations to have their own pandemic plans so that they can continue to provide essential services. And we're educating the public to be ready. We're giving you messages now, and our job will be, when pandemic starts, to keep you informed of what's happening, so you know what to do and how to protect yourselves. So what can you do? I'm going to hand this over to Nancy now, because she's going to say pretty much the same thing.
Can I not use that?
Mm-hmm. You go right ahead.
Are there lots of slides on here?
Nope. Okay. That's almost the end.
Okay. I was wondering about the time the flu started, 1918, September.
This is Nancy Fox. She's the public health response coordinator for the north end of the county. Yeah, I have another lady
behind
that.
Nancy.
No, on the inside.
Okay,
you got it. Yeah, I have another lady in the south end of the county that is our response coordinator, and their job is to help us plan for emergencies. And I'd also like to introduce Kathleen Gobin, who is the office supervisor in the Afton office. And we have Jean Tu, who's another one of the RNs in the office. There she is.
Stand up, Jean, so they can
stand up.
That's Jean.
Stand up so they can see you, Jean.
Come on, Jean, stand up.
And I bet you all know Helen Paul in the back, who is our lactation consultant. We're one of the few counties in the state that's privileged to have one. So we're very glad to have Helen.
Okay, well, thank you all again for venturing out, and I just want to take some time at the end, because now, is everybody scared, you know, have we gotten everybody's attention? I think through historical and getting a historical perspective on what happened and what we have seen in Star Valley, and then Sue gave us a wonderful update on why we should be concerned about this bird flu and why we're not seeing a lot of it. Well, what I want to do is just tell you that there are some things that we can do individually and as a family and as a community to prepare, and there's a lot that Lincoln County has been doing. I feel very comfortable in that telling you that I really believe that Lincoln County is one of the better prepared counties in the state of Wyoming. And one newspaper thing that I did see that was presented at a video conference with Michael Levitt, who is the Secretary of Health and Human Services. We had a meeting with throughout the state of Wyoming that was on a teleconference, video conference. But he had some very good remarks, and one of the slides that was shown by our Director of Health was that Lincoln County was one of the best counties that was facing the influenza in the state of Wyoming. So that gives me hope as well. So what we've done with public health and with the community, and I see lots of faces out there that have been at many of the presentations and the trainings that we have done, and I appreciate that, is we've taken a three-pronged approach to this. We've taken, first of all, we as public health need to be prepared for any emergency and any public health issue that comes with a disaster. That's what my job is. So I have worked with Sue and with my counterpart to put together a really good plan for public health response. We have an annex that addresses specifically a pandemic because it is a real threat. And we have done, in that event, we have done some mass vaccination clinics, and we have started to kind of think about different types of vaccinations. If it's a pandemic and people are sick, do we really want to put them together in a church building or somewhere and vaccinate them? So we've talked about, you know, doing van vaccinations and some different things, but we have worked to test our skills there. We have also started to stockpile equipment that we might need, protective equipment, syringes, with the hope that we would have some vaccination. We have been issued radios from the state so that eventually we'll be able to communicate directly to Cheyenne with our radios and some other communication equipment that is really nice. And so we're doing a lot of practicing and a lot of just upgrading our skills of what we do. So that's kind of the public health aspect. And then we've kind of ventured into what we call the family preparedness, and realizing that if this does happen, we all need to be able to survive for about a month. And there is a real culture in Star Valley with the one-year supply with the LDS Church. But regardless, we really strongly recommend each family, and to encourage, you know, extended family and neighbors and whatnot, to be able to pretty much be self-sufficient for a month. And to that extent, we're going to put some of these displays in the grocery stores with this information here. And I will pass some of these around. And you can take whatever you want, but this is our newest one. If you want to just take one, pass them around. But there's a variety of resources that we have there. If you raise poultry, there's some information on back on poultry that you might want to consider with bird flu. If you're a business, okay, so I'll grab it. But if there's a business, there's also one, just a short one geared towards your business, how to prepare your own business. There's some information on frequently asked questions, how to prepare, that the state gave us out. There's a longer, and many of you, who's been to a presentation of mine that's taken away one of the, anyway, there's this preparing for a pandemic by a physician. Yes?
In connection with your system, is there any program for what's the name of it? Pulling a family that's got the flu.
Quarantine. Oh, that's right. Quarantine and isolation. Well, yes, there could be. And in the beginning, it's thought that that might help when you just have a few cases. You might be able to quarantine some ill people. But once it starts to spread, it's been shown that that isn't very effective.
You don't have any program for it.
We do. We actually have some isolation orders and quarantine orders that could be issued. And the one person that's very important in public health is the county health officer. And our new county health officer is Dr. Bennett, in case you didn't know.
In reading about, trying to find out about the flu, the influenza, I found out that the Sam Kennington family in Aetna was quarantined for smallpox.
Hmm?
Two of the children have smallpox.
If I can just say,
sure.
You probably heard the terms isolation and quarantine. What they basically mean is that if you are already sick, you have the disease, we isolate that person from the community and care for them somewhere where they aren't going to be exposing other people to it and spreading it. Quarantine is when you may have been exposed to it, but we don't know if you're going to get sick or not, but we know you've been exposed, so we kind of ask you to stay away from the community so you don't give it to anybody else.
The trouble with flu is, like most viral illnesses,
you don't know.
You spread it before you know you got it.
That's exactly right.
Before you get the symptoms, you're already spreading.
Years ago, that used to be a prevalent thing to do, but I haven't heard of it recently.
That's because it doesn't work very well.
Yeah, once it starts to spread, it's not a real effective control.
When I was a kid, if the measles was going around, there was a sign on everybody's door, quarantine.
Well, isolation and quarantine are very useful in the beginning. That's why I said if we had good surveillance and we could pinpoint the first cases in the community, we can isolate those sick and ask the families to quarantine. But once it starts to spread, it gets out of control, and we don't have the means to enforce either quarantine, and we don't have the medical capability to isolate everyone who would be sick. We may be able to find a building where we could put 100 cots, but where are we going to find 100 nurses? You know, it's kind of impractical. So what we're looking at is asking people to self-quarantine. when we give out the word, it's time to go home, close the doors, and start eating those supplies that you've stocked up on. And then when we give you the word that's safe to come out, that's about all we can do.
Thanks for that clarification. Helen?
Can you talk a minute on West Nile virus and what the differences are?
Between the flu and the West Nile virus?
Yeah.
Well, I will give you a little information and Sue can kind of elaborate, but West Nile is vector spread by mosquitoes and by a certain mosquito. And it entered our country in the east in New York and has kind of slowly spread towards this end of the county. We've seen some cases in Idaho, you probably know. There was someone from Cokeville that contracted West Nile this last summer by going over to Idaho. They didn't get it here. And it is possible that this next summer we could see a few cases of West Nile virus. There is no vaccine. There's a horse vaccine, but there's not a human vaccine for West Nile at this point.
The thing to remember with West Nile virus is, as Nancy said, it's spread by a vector. An insect bites you, or an insect bites an infected animal, and then bites another animal or a human being, and it's transmitted through the blood of that insect. Influenza virus is transmitted by respiratory droplet, and droplets are drops of fluid. As you're breathing out, they're mostly microscopic or very small. And as I'm speaking now, I'm spreading them all over the room. But that's droplet infection, or it could be an aerosol. An aerosol is just basically very, very, very small droplets.
A normal person breathes out a quart and a half of fluid a day, just in their air.
So influenza is much more communicable and contagious than West Nile, because if you have West Nile, you can't give it to me unless you bite me, and some of your blood gets into mine.
And even then, I don't know. And there are different. There's a serious form of West Nile, which is neurological, and people die from it, and some of them don't recover. Then there's a less serious form that people kind of get the flu-type symptoms and recover. And then some people that actually become infected never get symptoms at all. So, but you will see a lot more information from Lincoln County Public Health as spring and summer progresses. As we get into that season, because we could be ripe for something. There's some indication our elevation may protect us a little bit, but we don't know. So, but thank you for asking that.
If a mosquito bites you and it has West Nile, you get it. If another mosquito bites you, does he get it and spread it that way?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's how they get it from, and birds, death of birds is a common indicator as well. So they're biting the birds and getting it from the birds.
We ought to kill the crows.
Yeah, and there's also a program if you find dead birds and you don't know exactly, you know, if they weren't hit by a car, you don't see an obvious reason, you can call our office, or there's this 1-800-WYOBITE, the State of Wyoming Health Department, and you can send the bird to the state lab and they will test it. If they'll kind of ask you a few questions on it, and if they think it's serious or there's a chance it's West Nile, then they would, and it's one of our surveillance mechanisms for West Nile. But getting back to pandemic, if that's okay, we have three-pronged approach. One is the preparing public health. Second is family. And our third is infrastructure. So family preparedness, we do a lot of education. Part of this is our family preparedness. I've probably given a presentation about 30 to 45 minutes, and I'd be glad to do it for your community group, your church group. I've gone to the Chamber of Commerce, the Rotary Club, a lot of church groups, women's groups, lots of different groups, and giving them just a 30-minute presentation on the town councils is another place I've been, what a pandemic is and how to prepare, kind of what Sue did here, but a little bit more in depth. And so I'd be glad to do that. So family preparedness is a big thing, and being able to do that self-quarantine is something that we very much do appreciate. We did have family preparedness classes, and I know there are a few people that attended those that Chief Phillips from Alpine did. And that was very good, some more advanced topics on preparedness that we all learned about. So that's a big focus, and we work closely with Homeland Security, which used to be called Emergency Management, to that end, because we do feel like we do have this pandemic threat hanging out there, and we think we'll all just be so much more prepared if we can do that. And community infrastructure, we have been working with, as Sue said, a pandemic would have a disastrous effect on our infrastructure, our small hospital. How do we get things into the county? How do we get things into Star Valley?
By truck.
By truck. If 30% of the truck drivers are sick, 20% are taking care of their family members or more, the trucks might not roll. So our little grocery stores do not have supplies. I've been working with Paul Stauffer. He's on our planning committee, and we talk about pharmaceuticals. If you have, if you're on regular prescription medication, you need to somehow get a month ahead supply. And I know that's hard with insurance, and they're trying to change the regulations, but he has, what do you say, Paul, a couple days supply?
Yeah, we try to keep our inventories low, yeah.
Yeah, so 2 to 3 days supply. So if you've got some regular medications, try and, I mean, that's a very important thing to try and get ahead on. So that's something, again, that we, that's the family preparedness.
Nancy, a point on that, because a lot of people think that they have to come in the day that their prescription is due for the next refill, the very day. Most of these insurance companies will let you come in a few days early.
Right, and my husband's been doing that.
You can start building up by doing that each time.
So go in a few days early every month, and then by the end of the year, maybe you'll have your month's supply, see? So we do have this community task force, and we have been working for a long time. We've had a healthcare coalition that got together about 3 years ago just to prepare for public health and medical emergencies. Then about 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago, the pandemic kind of came on the horizon, and we started doing what we call tabletop exercises, and it's kind of a, what if this happens, what do we do? And we did that with our local emergency planning committee, and then with our healthcare group and our planning group, to say, what do we do, you know, if the pandemic comes at this stage? What decisions do we make? You know, we may have to prioritize, you know, who's going to get power. I was at one meeting where the Lower Valley Energy guy turned to the Simplot guy and said, well, if we have to, you know, if we have to ration power, I think the hospital might come ahead of you guys or something like that. So they were kind of talking about that. And the people that serve, we have so many organizations that are involved in that. We have the pharmacists that are involved. Paul's been there. We have the coroner. We have the hospital. We have utilities. We have the school district. Robert's been there. Just a wide variety, Homeland Security, EMS, fire departments, kind of a wide group because a pandemic would affect all of those infrastructure elements. So, and we've come up with some good ideas, but we won't have it completely covered, but we are coming up with some plans and with some, you know, how we would cope. And the idea is that as the pandemic comes in, as Sue says, it will come in waves where people will get sick and some people will die and then it'll go away and then it'll come back. We know we're not going to stop it, so what we're basically trying to do is to make it littler waves. We're still going to get some sick people. We're still going to get some people dying if this does happen, but our goal is to minimize that as much as we can. So that's kind of what we've been doing. We've also worked with the hospital, did an exercise, a functional exercise, what they would do and how they would handle a pandemic-type situation, and that was, I think, very helpful for them. One of the things that, Sue, I hope you don't mind me mentioning, is that okay? As I hold it up, now I have to mention it.
It just went to the press.
It did just go to the press. We had our last pandemic task force meeting yesterday, and Sue Pearson and Connie Sweeney, a nurse from the south end, and Louise Hughes, a nurse from this end, have been working on a program called Caring for the Sick at Home When It's the Only Option. And we already said our hospitals were going to be overwhelmed, and they have put this together to help give us the skills that we may have lost in caring for sick people at home without getting everybody else sick at the same time. And do you want to say anything else about it, Sue? I mean, it's a wonderful DVD. I have a lot of people, I told people about a year ago we were doing this, and they are calling me every month from other states asking me about it. So it will be available.
Yes, we have a local fellow, I think some of you may know him, James Phillips, who is the police chief up in Alpine. He also has, he does DVD reproduction. So, and he was very kind to take the presentation that we designed and he put it in the DVD format so that you can take this home, put it in your DVD players at home and watch it on your television. It's not something you have to have a computer for. If you have a computer that plays DVDs, that's fine too, but everybody that has a DVD player and a TV can watch it. I gave him an order this week to produce roughly 1,000 copies, and I got the money from a pandemic grant from the federal government.
And so we'll have that available, I'm hoping within a week or two, and we'll be having those available at the health fairs. So if you'd like a copy, we'll probably ask for a small donation just to cover the cost of the DVDs, and he's going to give me the final quote real soon. But it won't be more than $10, probably between $5 and $10.
And if they wanted to check one out from our office, they could probably do that?
Yes.
So we'll have them available to check out.
I don't want anybody to feel like they can't get one. Somehow or other, you'll get one.
Okay. And then a couple other things. I know we're after 8, but one thing I did want to mention, and this is two things. This is a DVD that you can also check out from our office, and it's called The Influenza 1918, and it's a great documentary by PBS that goes through and interviews people and talks about how different communities did better or how communities were affected, and it is very good. I would recommend it. Very good.
Nancy? There's a real good piece on Salt Lake in there. They do a
where the mail carrier finally brought it in. Mm-hmm. So that's a good one. And then Sue talked about this. This is The Great Influenza by John Berry. That's a good history of the 1918 influenza. And then if any of you are historical fiction fans, and my husband, he knows I'm, my kids say I'm obsessed with this, but I'm really not. But he brought me a book, and it's called The Last Town on Earth. But it's fiction, but it's very good on a fictional town near Seattle and how this town coped with it. And they did bring up the whiskey thing, Lloyd. But I read that, because Lloyd and I have talked before. And when I read that, I was just, I didn't have to tell Lloyd about that. But they did bring up something on whiskey and helping with the influenza. So it's not an endorsement, but it was in this book. So, and the last thing I want to bring up, and this is something Homeland Security and Public Health are really trying to encourage, is for everybody to get in their household some sort of NOAA weather radio. This is the warning system. If there's ever an emergency, an earthquake, they will use the weather radio right away to get information out. If there's a pandemic, this is how the public health through the incident command system will get information out. This is what Preparedness Santa brought me for Christmas. I went and got it and wrapped it and put it under the tree, you know, but but it's great. It is really nice. I can get AM, FM, weather, TV, and it can wind. I even, Radio Shack helped me find the right little, plug-in for it, and I can crank it, and I can do regular batteries. So it's real. I really encourage that. This is another one that's available that's just the weather one. And it's the NOAA weather that you can just plug in. And the health department gave us these, and I've given them out to some of the smaller communities that are kind of isolated. And you can set these on alert so that if there's an alert, it will come on. And these are probably about $30.
What does the other one cost?
This one cost me, I got it on sale, but it was $45.
Where do you get them?
This was Radio Shack.
Radio Shack.
So, and they do have quite a few. You could look on the web, too, if you want. The brand, this is the major brand I see, is called Eaton. And I told Radio Shack I was going to be coming here that, you know, better stock up on those. But we do encourage that. And if you do have any questions, you know where we're located in town, 421 Jefferson, in with the county annex building.
Nancy just outlined the three-pronged attack that we have on pandemic flu. We're doing the best we can, and we have wonderful people to work with, but I can't emphasize enough that it's really all of us working together. We can't help you if you don't help yourself. In the south end of the county, I brought an advertisement. The Jubilee Supermarket is having their case lot sale, and I imagine your supermarket up here has
coming soon. I saw that.
And they've gone out of their way to buy extra supplies and paper products and bottled water, and we have a display just like this down there. You'll have this in your supermarkets, and the supermarket managers are encouraging people to stock up on supplies.
The same thing is true in Thane.
Yes.
They have their...
Mm-hmm. Yes. And so now is the time to do it.
I have a fifth of whiskey that's given
I'm coming to your house. I'm going to take
the whiskey. So I'm set.
And what we say is anything you do to prepare for a pandemic is not going to be wasted time, money, or effort. I bet there's a lot of people in Oklahoma this week wish they had a lot of supplies and extra power sources and heat supplies to tide them through the storm that they've just gone through. So.
Well, we thank Public Health for coming and telling us about this.
I'll bet you didn't know that Robert was a graduate in microbiology. Robert, do you want to take a few minutes and tell us why viruses are so damn mean?
Just, they mutate, and you just know what you can defend against.
Yeah, I did not know that.
Come up here, Robert.
Come on, get Robert up.
Most of you.
Well, that's okay. You've heard it all.
But they haven't. But you can. But Robert's a graduate in microbiology, and if you didn't know that, maybe he can tell you some things about
it. Mechanic.
Yeah, that's why I'm telling you. So you get surprised every day, don't you?
But viruses
mutate. They want to survive in spite of us. And we want to survive in spite of them. Any more questions for anyone before we dismiss?
I need to ask a couple more questions. I'm just one of these young guys, and I'm just young compared to all you guys. But
you'll get wiped out first.
Now, some of you guys know me, and you know where I come from, and you know some of my background and what I do for a livelihood. But one question I have is when they had the plagues and stuff in Europe and England, who knows about the story of the thieves back then? I need to know if any medical organization actually knows that story and what happened.
I haven't heard it. I know that there was two pandemics of the plague in Europe in the 1300s and the 1600s, and they killed about a third of the population of Europe.
That's a little
maybe
strange.
He knows it.
The
kids tell us.
The kids talk about just ring around a rosy pocketbook.
Oh, yes.
See, all fall down. That's came from
that came from that.
The bike did.
Well, if there's no more questions, we'll dismiss. Sure.
If I can take 1 minute, I would like to explain it briefly, because I feel that's partly has to do with preparedness as far as current, what we're doing now. And I also feel it has partly to do with the history that we've been given. And that's one reason I came here tonight, is I feel I would be amiss if I didn't ask that question and see if someone knew the story and see what happened. And I'd like to tell that story very briefly, if I'm allowed to.
I'd like to hear it.
Go ahead.
Go up to the mic.
Okay.
Come up to the microphone so they can hear you.
All right. I will make this brief. Again, a lot of you know me. These two ladies may not, but a lot of you know me.
I don't.
You know I gather garbage with Mike Astle. And you know you see me out there in 20 below weather riding on the back of the truck. I never get sick. That doesn't mean anything, but I don't get sick.
Neither do I. I've only missed 2 days of work in 50 years. And I'm around it all the time. And the reason I don't get sick is because I'm around it all the time. Mm-hmm. See, it's a matter of resistance more than a matter of exposure.
I believe that, and that's true. And that's why I'm going to make this brief, because I do have a point to this. Back in England, a lot of you have heard about the Black Plague or the Black Death. Okay? And back then, they had the story of the thieves that went around stealing from the dying and the dead and breaking into the homes and taking the valuables. And it got the attention of the king because it went on for days and months, and none of these thieves got sick. And the king of England finally had them all arrested and said, if you will tell me why you are not getting sick when everybody else is dying, the sentence will be more lenient. Well, come to find out, and I had to look this up on the internet because I didn't want to come just blab my mouth off. Yeah, I wanted to have a few facts. Come to find out, this particular family lineage was all what they call perfumers. In other words, herbalists. And I know that's along a different line than the medical field. And we have already had the comment that it can't be discussed, that that's not the field that we're talking about. We're coming from the medical standpoint. And that's why I asked some of these specific questions where it was coming from. Come to find out, they were all perfumers, and they worked with oils and natural ingredients like the trees and the bark and so forth that some have mentioned, and they never did get sick. And we had a person named Gary Young back in the late 1900s, 1980-1990, and he got from a person named Jean Valnet from France. What this concoction actually was that kept these thieves from getting sick. They never did die, and everybody around them was dying. And he concocted from that an oil that they call thieves. And it's all it is natural oils, natural concoctions that are made up, and natural ingredients that are made up. Vinegar is one of the substances, and they make it up into a liquid, and they store it, and they use it when they need to. Now, I'm going to end my story there. I know there might be some more interest, and it's all I'm going to say is, if there's interest, call me. You know who I am. And if there is interest on the part of you two and the public health office, please contact me, and I will share anything I know. And I can get in contact with anybody that will also share about these same kind of things. I know it's different than the medical field, but I have used it, and I have cured pneumonia in 2 days using it myself when I've had it 3 times before, no doubt because I've gone to the doctor and he's given me the penicillin, and I've been instructed to take it for 10 days to get better. And so I'm a believer in some of the natural substances, and I have to say that, because it seems like the only line we're going on here is from the medical point of view and everything that can be done there. And there are avenues that can assist that are very valuable to all of us. And I want everybody to know that, because I've proven it myself with things that I have done. Keep your whiskey. That's why I asked if the hot water saved your life. There may be something with it that the medical society hasn't grabbed. The same with the whiskey, the same with some of the natural remedies. And I want them to come to life. Okay. I appreciate that. That's all the time I'm going to take. I just wanted to say that.
Can I offer one idea? And this is something to the Historic Society that just came to me tonight. And it's just an idea I'd like to throw out. Mike Richens, who is our county coroner, and I have had this idea that would like to interview people who either had ancestors, grandparents, parents that lived through the 1918 influenza, and just maybe do a group interview where we could record some of that information in a video. And if there's interest in that, through the Historical Society or, you know, Dennis Lloyd, and I heard some other women talking about their relatives, I just think it might have value as public health and for history, our local history as well.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. So if anyone's interested in that, you have family members that have tales to tell, contact Nancy with public health. We appreciate everyone's coming out tonight and your participation. Anything, Jerry?
Do we have an election?
Did we get all of the ballots in that we for our election? Did you? We've got some up here, Judy. And I had a. What happened to that sweater that was here?
It's right here. I just put. Is that your sweater?
No, no,
it's not. Right here.
We had this sweater left at the dinner in November. If it belongs to someone. Thank you, everyone. Thanks, Dr. Perks and Nancy and Sue. Thank you
very much.
Thank you, Nancy.
Surely. So call if you have questions.